Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett, and we begin, as always, with a look back at the week's events as covered by our WFPL news team in the first segment of our program. And with us are Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. Philip M. Bailey has an excused absence again today. He'll be back with us next week. I want to welcome everyone else. Welcome.
Thanks.
We welcome your input as well. 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Or toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK. That's 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through our Facebook page. Let's begin, Gabe Bullard, with Mayor Greg Fisher's State of the City address yesterday. And he warned of some tough budget times ahead.
Yeah, we had heard all year these threats of budget cuts or these hints that budget cuts were coming. Looks like the city is facing a $12 million shortfall for the current fiscal year, so that's through June, and then $20 to $30 million that will have to be cut out of the next city budget. This marks, gosh, I guess 5 years almost, yeah, straight of budget cuts, both mid-year budget cuts being necessary and beginning of fiscal year budget cuts, just as the effects of the recession linger on.
I covered the speech yesterday at the Rotary Club. He didn't get real specific about what's being looked at for possible cuts, but he did mention some employee benefit programs, mm-hmm, and also these external agencies.
Yeah, these external agencies, that's something that last year the mayor said they would need to have a plan B in place. There's a lot of social services agencies, Center for Women and Families, groups like that, and a lot of arts groups. Fund for the Arts, I believe, has received some. Squalls Puppeteers, I think, gets some. Louisville Public Media as well, just as a disclaimer, occasionally, yeah, will get some city funding. Now, those grants, that's something that these organizations have long said goes to provide a service that the city cannot or that the city should not necessarily provide, but that should foster. The thing is, that's a piece of the budget that the mayor is saying is going to have to be cut. This plan B, we asked him about it when he was on the show on our airwaves. Was it last week or the week before? Philip had asked him what that plan B was. The mayor said that's not necessarily an across-the-board cut, but something that these agencies are going to have to be a little more creative with how they pitch their funds and everything. It's still unclear, though, how far that creativity will go. These external agencies likely have, over the last few years, come to realize that they're going to start losing some of their city money, and so it's not clear how much of that, what the fund is going to be to spread around to all these different groups.
So budgets are usually for fiscal year, starting July 1st, but ahead of time, the departments begin looking at the budget for the following year, and then it's submitted to the Metro Council, and there will be hearings.
Yeah, there's always budget hearings. June is the big budget month in the council. The mayor, usually around late May, will come and introduce his budget, give his address to the full council. That's the only time, typically, that the mayor of Louisville meets with the entire Metro Council. Mayor Fisher has added an extra event, a breakfast, usually at the beginning of the year, mm-hmm, as well, but that's not really a business meeting, they say. So yeah, he'll give that address in May, and we'll learn some of that. We'll probably start to see some of these $12 million in budget cuts come out at some point. He mentioned overtime as well, right, is something, yeah, that's going to have to be cut. That's something, this employee overtime that he's been studying or has launched the study of to make sure there's not some abuse in the system.
Now, there was some grumbling here over the last week or so from people who live in the urban services district, the old city, about their garbage was not picked up. Usually on a holiday, it's picked up the following day, or recycling, and that wasn't the case this time, and it won't be the case next week for the because of the King holiday. The mayor said they would save about $50,000 by just waiting to the following week to pick up garbage or recycling. And that has drawn some complaints, not only from people who live in the old city, but also Councilman Tom Owen, among others.
Yeah, Councilman Tom Owen represents the 8th District, which, while I believe there may be a few areas outside of the old city limits in his district, he does represent that urban district. And the urban services district, you know, like you said, it's the old city limits, and people in that district pay an extra tax in exchange for extra services, garbage collection being one of them. Tom Owen has said, and he had said in years past even, that he feels that sometimes these budget cuts, these those urban services are cut and those residents who are paying for a service are paying the same to get less. And he has often said that's not too fair. And now he's saying that the mayor really didn't do a good job of communicating this, didn't do a really good job of planning, that the savings maybe are not as significant as they could be given that some people are going to go a few weeks without having their garbage collected. It's interesting to see the public reaction on this too, because for a lot of people, you know, who don't, say, work in a newsroom and are always catching up on what the city does, garbage collection is one of those things that happens. And that's, you know, the face-to-face interaction with the city for a lot of people. And so when that's not there, that's something that people are going to notice more than they might notice, you know, a mayoral appointment or some changes in City Hall. They're going to notice whenever a service provided to them vanishes.
Yeah, they say we pay the taxes, you pick up the garbage.
Exactly.
Yeah, in my neighborhood, I live in the South End, and it's Monday is usually a recycling day, and I'd say about half the people in our neighborhood didn't really get the message that we were going to hold off for a week. And someone asked the mayor about that yesterday. They have a question and answer session after a State of the City speech yesterday, and here was his response.
When your garbage isn't picked up and you don't know about it, you get particularly upset. So I think probably there could have been better communication, and it's hard to communicate to the whole city where everybody's paying attention and reading or listening. But we can always do a better job of communicating. But this is a real interesting scenario for everybody to think about. Okay, we save $50,000 there. So what are we talking about in terms of our budget problem for next year? $20, $30 million. So with all of the, and I won't say all, there's a small group of people that are very loud, and that's the way it is on any organization, and I get that. I mean, I'm a Monday garbage guy, too. I don't like it, you know. But you deal with it because that's the money that we have to work with. Now, that's a rational response to it. A lot of people don't respond that way. So we need to, as we're taking a look at next year's budget challenges, to make sure that we're communicating effectively, that we're explaining what the trade-offs are. Maybe someday the hundreds of thousands of people will rush downtown and say, we want to increase our taxes and get garbage picked up every day. I don't know. But we'll be ready.
I'm not so sure about that's going to happen. I think he might have been joking. But anyway, he talks like maybe there could be more of the same in the coming budget.
Yeah, that's going to be something to watch out for, especially. And one thing Tom Owen had said is that he would hope that there'd be some balance more so between residents of the old city and residents of the old county and who's going to have to bear the brunt of some of these service cuts.
And Erica Peterson, this kind of dovetails into a story that you covered. The mayor has appointed a director of sustainability.
Yeah, and it's something that a lot of people, especially in the light of budget cuts and this garbage pickup, have said, really, is this the best time? I believe somebody on Twitter said maybe she can sustain my garbage delivery. but this was a position that was budgeted for back in the summer, and it's taken this long to fill it. There have been a couple hiccups in the hiring process, but they have finally picked someone. It is Maria Cutter. Who lives in Louisville, and she has about 20 years of experience in sustainability consulting. She's consulted for, companies like Shell and Halliburton, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency. And a couple of years ago, she founded her own consulting firm here in the city called Be Green 2.
So what will she be doing in this new role?
Well, that's one of the things that has been kind of a question for a while, because it's a very large position. There are lots of ways you can implement sustainable measures and things like that in cities like this. But it's a one-person department. So it's just her. And basically, the mayor has said that she'll be responsible for consulting with every city agency and working with them and using their employees to implement more sustainable measures. And when I talked to her the other day when she was this was announced, she said that she's not worried about it. She thinks it's good to have a large job description because it kind of lets you feel the way you're supposed to go and not be pigeonholed into something like this. But she is scheduled to start next Wednesday, I believe.
And Gabe, this is part of a larger announcement, a kind of a shuffling of economic development in the mayor's administration.
Yeah, there's no more Department of Economic Development. It's now called the Department for Economic Growth and Innovation. This is something Mayor Fischer has done a little bit over the last year, or his first year in office, is rename certain departments. We saw him bring back the Office of International Affairs and rename it the Office for Globalization, appoint another single member to that department. We saw the mayor promise to create a Department of Military Affairs, and we saw the mayor appoint Ted Smith as Director of Innovation. Well, in this reshuffling of the Economic Development Department, he had asked Margaret Hanmaker, who was the interim Economic Development Chief, to look at the city's economic strategy and come up with some changes. One was the change for the name and the new focus. Ted Smith is going to be leading this department, and he's leaving behind the Office of Innovation. That he will not be replaced in that position. So that new office that existed for about 6 months at $100,000 a year is now gone. Ted Smith will get about a $13,000 raise or so in his new position. The Office of Military Affairs will not be created anymore under this, and the Office of Sustainability and Globalization will work under Smith in some capacities there. And so it's pretty interesting to see that the mayor talked about these four new offices. These four offices that were going to be created have now, for the most part, sustainability aside and globalization aside in the title, at least, they've been folded into the Department of Economic Development, essentially being assigned to an employee or someone who might be brought in or promoted within that department. And the real controversy so far around the city's economic development over the last year has been Greater Louisville Inc., the city's Chamber of Commerce, largely private funded, as most chambers of commerce are, but they get about $1 million a year from Metro government. Last year, the council held off on allocating half of that until they could do some reviews and look at how GLI has been doing. There's been a lot of critiques over how successful GLI has been. The former director, when Joe Reagan left, the director who had been in charge of the agency before him, said that GLI didn't necessarily do enough to foster local businesses, to help grow some small businesses, encourage startups and all that in Louisville. GLI folks, in their defense, they say that, you know, that's been a tough few years with the recession and everything. The actual number of jobs in Louisville as of September of last year was pretty much exactly, give or take 1,000 or so, what it was 10 years prior. There was something of a lost decade with jobs. Granted, some jobs left, some new jobs came in, but there's really not much of a gain overall. So those are the criticisms of GLI, and GLI, they say, you know, they're starting to get their footing more. They've helped bring some jobs to Ford. They've helped bring some jobs to GE and all that. But the city is not going to, in its new economic development strategy, change its relationship with GLI. They're going to still continue to provide this $1 million. And I asked Chris Pointer, the mayor's spokesman, about that, and this is what he said.
There are things that GLI can do that city government cannot. They can be more nimble. They can react quicker because they're not technically a government agency. They don't have to put out bids, for example, to do certain things. So there is a real strong value when you're working on economic development deals to be able to have sort of a non-government entity that can work more quickly.
And it kind of plays into these things that the mayor has long been saying about they have to figure out the core functions of government. What can the city do? What can't the city do? And GLI, just like some of these external arts and social services agencies, they're saying provides a service that should be provided that the city can help foster, but not necessarily one that the city could do on its own for the same amount of money.
All right. And of course, the search continues for a new GLI director as Joe Reagan has gone on to St. Louis.
Yes.
All right, Devin Katayama. Thanks, Gabe. Devin Katayama, we turn to you for some education developments. Big story this week at Jefferson County Public Schools, where the school board has approved some pretty big changes to its student assignment plan.
Yeah, this was a long-anticipated vote by the school board. It was expected last month they could have taken the issue up to give, I think, the district a little more time to prepare staff and students and the community about the changes. But they did vote at the first school board meeting of the year to unanimously approve the small changes to the student assignment plan. This will affect some 2,000, they're estimating, elementary school students who are currently in JCPS elementary schools, they will have a shorter bus ride is what's being estimated right now. And going forward, kindergarten students will be applying for elementary schools. The kindergarten students will apply and go to that school until fifth grade, unless there's some sort of change, like they want to change the school, then they'll have the option to kind of go to the district and go through that process as well.
So is there the same number of, for lack of a better term, zones where students
They're using
live?
The word clusters. But yeah, that was another thing that was constantly in flux during the whole process of going through these proposals was how many clusters are there going to be. We are going to keep the six clusters that are currently, or we're maintaining six clusters. They're doing a little bit different measurements of diversity now. So they're going to be using the census blocks. There's 570 census blocks in JCPS. And they're going to be defining diversity based on those blocks. And those blocks are still going to be based on educational attainment, income, and race. But the block will determine what a student's diversity is and thereby determine what schools they can go to. Now, they're saying that they can parents will have the choice between six schools this time around instead of the normal four. And that's something that they'll explain at the end of the month at the elementary showcase.
And this will go into effect next academic year?
This next school year, this upcoming school year, which is why they needed to know as soon as possible, basically, what the changes were going to be. Now, several board members seem to think that this was a first step, a good first step, but only a first step. They're expecting another plan that will affect elementary through high school later on in the spring, which I think will be some bigger changes. But they're also going to have to, make any changes that might be determined by the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, which will weigh in on the student assignment plan in April.
All right. Thank you, Devin. We'll be keeping an eye on that. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL, and we're speaking with our news roundtable, minus Philip M. Bailey, who's who'll be back with us next week. And we welcome your input as well. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, or toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Erica Peterson, I want to go back to you on the environment front. There's a new natural resources commissioner that has been named for the state of Kentucky.
Yes, there is. As you might remember, the previous natural resources commissioner was fired without cause at the end of November. And that was met with a lot of surprise, I think, by everyone who's dealt with him. Carl Campbell was kind of unanimously praised by both the coal industry and the environmental communities for at least always keeping an open mind, being willing to meet with both sides with both sides of that debate. And the position's been vacant since then. And so finally, Secretary Len Peters announced that the position will be filled by Steve Homan, who has been in charge of the state's abandoned mine lands program up until now. He's been there for about 16 years, and he was a reclamation inspector before that. So he does have a lot of experience in the position.
So what's been the response to this appointment?
So far, optimism. I spoke with Bill Bissett of the Kentucky Coal Association. He said his dealings with Steve Homan have always been good. And Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resources Council as well said that, he thought it was a good pick. His concern was, will he be allowed to do his job? Will he be allowed to make controversial decisions? And in this position, he's going to be over the natural resources umbrella is really big, and it covers oil and gas and forestry and mine permits and mine safety and reclamation. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Fitzgerald was concerned about one issue is that for a long time, the federal government has been saying that we need to increase the amount of bonds that coal companies pay in the state of Kentucky, because they pay this money. And then if they don't reclaim the land properly or at all, the bond is kept to do that. And the bonds have historically been pretty small. And so Fitzgerald was saying that that was a big thing that the commissioner needs to do. And he was worrying that the Beshear administration would kind of put up some resistance to that.
Was there ever any reason given for the firing of Campbell?
Nope, he was a political appointee, and there was no reason given, and nobody so far that I've seen has been able to find any concrete evidence saying that people were complaining about this or that issue.
Okay, thank you, Erica. We'll be keeping an eye on Mr. Homan's progress in the the Natural Resources Cabinet. Back to you, Devin Katayama, for just a moment. As you spent some time this week with Kentucky U.S. Senator Rand Paul, and he announced that he's turning back some of his money. What's this
it
about?
It was actually a pretty interesting press conference. I spoke with a number of media before the press conference, and they didn't really know what he was going to unveil at the time. But what he's decided to do is give back $500,000 of his operational budget. He says state senators get $3 million appropriated for the year for office budgets, and now he's giving back $500,000, which is partly what he campaigned on, he says. And this is his, you know, we all know that he's for downsizing government. And I think this was a big show for you know, his position on that.
And so this money will go back just to the Treasury?
Right. The giant check that he unveiled was made out to U.S. taxpayers. He says it will go back to the U.S. Treasury to try to pay off some of the debt. He also says, you know, if everybody did this sort of savings, then they would, I think it, he said $130 million a year with if every congressman and every senator kind of did this, they would have significant savings. And he also said that they are kind of afraid to not spend that money because if they don't spend that money, then they don't get it the next year. So he says people are quick to think of the money as money that needs to be spent.
And speaking of money, while I have you here, we'll talk about the hiring freeze announced at the University of Louisville.
Yeah, the University of Louisville has decided to put on a hiring freeze because they're anticipating budget cuts. They say 5 to 7% budget cuts in higher education, and that's just really their estimate at this point. They sent out a letter to faculty and staff saying only major positions that really need to be filled will be considered at this time. And it's still kind of uncertain what that budget's going to look like. So I think that it will go into the spring as far as the hiring freeze and then them considering who they're going to be hiring in the near future.
All right. Thank you, Devin. Go back to you, Gabe Bullard. There was a forum on visual arts and the fund for the arts held last night. I think you took part in that. You were the moderator. And why do they have it?
Well, I had moderated this. There was, if you remember what happened about 10, 11 months ago even, it seems like the time has really flown by, with the Fund for the Arts, there was some concern that the Fund for the Arts, which is an umbrella arts organization that gives money to a lot of its member organizations, was not favoring the visual arts, or it was giving more money to the performing arts and not to the visual arts. The Louisville Visual Art Association and some other visual artists took issue with this. They said that they deserved funding, more funding as well, or more equitable funding. That led to a voicemail from former CEO Alan Cowan, his eventual retirement amid some of the controversy over his behavior with this situation and his interactions with some of the artists. And now with Barbara Sexton Smith, she is acting as the interim president until a new president is appointed. The fund has done some things. They're looking at their allocation process. They have a committee to do that. They're looking at their board size and everything. And the visual artists invited Barbara Sexton Smith to this forum yesterday to ask her a lot of questions about what could happen with funding, what might happen with the visual arts, how they might be treated. And the Fund for the Arts is, they get a lot of their money from what are called these employee campaigns. They go to workplaces. I'm sure a lot of people listening may have had a Fund for the Arts representative, maybe Barbara Sexton Smith herself, come to their workplace to say, you can have a payroll deduction to go to the Fund for the Arts, all of that. She gave some information pointing out that they have about 200 of these workplace campaigns. They want to add at least 100 over the years. So if they could get more money, they could give more money to the visual arts, was one argument she was making. They have about 30% participation overall. And the visual artists then started bringing in some of their complaints. One was the lack of transparency. They've opened up these board meetings at the Fund for the Arts. Another was the size of the board itself. This is a board that has 60-plus members on it. It's very large. Barbara Sexton Smith, she compared it to a board of overseers for a university and said the executive board is a bit more like a board of trustees. But even she acknowledged it's quite large. Board members have 3-year terms. They can cycle out after that, or they have the option to serve one more term. And it's kind of like the U.S. Senate in this regard, in that there are 20 members that leave 1 year, 20 members another, 20 members another, when these terms expire. So of the 20 members who were leaving last April or so, once she became interim president, she said that she asked them if they would rotate out so they could make the board more diverse. Visual artists want more visual artists on the board. They want just more representation from the arts community. more people of just of various geographic backgrounds throughout Indiana, throughout the state. They want the board to be less white than it is, and younger, more females on the board, all of that. Well, Barbara said that only 5% or 5 people, 25% of those who were asked to cycle out actually did. And one problem with that is a lot of times these employee campaigns are being somewhat held hostage, as she described it, by these board members. They say, well, if I can't be on the board, I don't want money, or I don't want an employee campaign at my workplace. So that was one issue with the visual artists. As far as actual funding to the visual arts, the core issue there, she said that this allocation process is coming, much like the city. The fund is going to only have to be able to reward the most innovative, the most creative pitches. That'll be shown, and when this new allocation process is out, it will make some people very happy, she said. It will make some people very upset, and so we're just waiting to see that allocation process, and that's being determined by a panel right now.
Now, the fund was headed for years by Alan Cowan, who stepped down last week after coming under some criticism. He'd been at the helm for many years. What's he doing now?
He is working for U of L.
He is.
Oddly enough, he has been contracted. His consulting firm, Alan Cowan Consulting, has been asked to do some research on this option downtown. U of L was slated to move its MBA and MFA programs into Museum Plaza. They now have an option to buy up that land now that the tower has been canceled. And Alan Cowan's looking into that for them. He's looking into how the university could have a downtown presence that they want to have. They want to be a metropolitan university, and that means having this urban presence, having these connections with other arts agencies and organizations and groups throughout the city, and that's something that he's working on. It's a $50,000 contract for 6 months with an option to renew.
All right, thanks to Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, our WFPL news team. Great work as always this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take our first break. Coming up, we'll turn our attention to the Kentucky General Assembly with Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. It's right after the break. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the Kentucky General Assembly continues in Frankfort, although lawmakers took, a snow day today, Kenny. And we'll be back on the job on Tuesday. And joining us to talk about it is Kenny Colston, the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Is that what happened? They kind of called off business today because of the threat of
It's a legislative snow day today. Unfortunately, we don't get a snow day. I'm a little bit upset about that, I guess. But they decided that some areas obviously are getting a little bit more snow than others. Some of the rural legislators, yeah, you know, obviously it's hard for them to get back home. So they took a day off today, put one in the bank, and that I guess they'll use at the end of the session.
All right, and they will return on Tuesday because we have a holiday on Monday. And that's why you're with us today, because the General Assembly not in session, so you're able to come visit with us in person. Let's start with redistricting. This is not really one of the sexier agenda items, but it's very important to voters across the state. Where do we stand on redrawing the legislative districts this time?
Well, the House has pretty much finished up their portion of redistricting. They have new judicial maps out. They have They passed new House districts for themselves, and they've passed a congressional redistricting plan. So in their mind, they're just waiting to see what the Senate changes. Now, in the past, it's always been common practice that the House draws their lines, the Senate draws their own districts, and they don't mess with each other. And I think that's going to be the case here. But the Senate definitely does not like the congressional map that the House passed out. So there'll probably be a little bit of infighting over that, and they'll have to go to conference committee. And hopefully by the end of next week or the week after, they hope to have redistricting done. The filing deadline is January 31st. They don't really want to, you know, push back that deadline, but they may have to. So we're kind of, a third of the way in. The House is finished. Now It's the Senate's turn, and then they have to agree.
Now, this is something that's done after each census as there are population shifts. Now, do they redraw just the congressional districts or also their own districts?
No, they redrew their own districts, and that was kind of a point of contention this week. House Republicans are upset because up to 10 of their own incumbents could be facing each other. I think the most, the point that they don't like the most is in the new 17th House District in Bowling Green. There's 3 current Republicans who got mashed into that district. So you're talking about at least 2 Republican incumbents that won't be coming back to the legislature. They've done it in other areas, and Republicans were really upset about that. They had a big floor fight last night, a lot of talk about court and suing and about the Constitution. But in the end, the Democrats won out. They control that chamber.
It's also almost every session, it seems like we talk about the methamphetamine problem in Kentucky, and there's another effort to have one of the main ingredients in meth, pseudoephedrine, more tightly regulated.
Right, yeah. The House and the Senate Judiciary Committees heard their first committee meetings on this issue, and they had people from Oklahoma and Mississippi, two other states that have really been trailblazers when it comes to regulating pseudoephedrine. They had directors of those states' Bureau of Narcotics come in and basically testify. And their main point was is that if you want to eliminate the meth problem, if you want to eliminate meth labs, make pseudoephedrine by prescription only. Obviously, there's a lot of groups who don't like that. The Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, a lot of, you know, small government and citizens groups, because they say, don't punish us, punish the criminals. There is a compromise bill out there that would restrict pseudoephedrine by prescription only to people who have meth convictions only. And that's a bill that's being pushed out there as well. That may get a little traction in the House. It's not going to get a lot of traction in the Senate.
Pseudoephedrine, an ingredient, I guess we should say, in many, many cold medicines that are now bought over-the-counter, although I tried to buy some the other day and they had to check my license and all that sort of thing.
Right.
But it's found in a lot of medications.
Right, yeah, and that's the reforms that Kentucky, you just mentioned a reform that Kentucky already has. When you buy pseudoephedrine, you have to go to the counter. You know, someone has to look at you. They have to look at your license. They put that information in there immediately into the meth check registry, which is an instant reporting process. And there's no doubt that that system is working. What the compromise bill wants to do is tighten that system up a little bit, and so that, you know, people don't come in, and it would crack down on what they call smurfing, which is where people pay you know, other people like $50 to go in and buy a case of Sudafed, hand it off, and then they go make the meth. But that, you know, obviously that would track those people. You would catch the smurfers, then you would lead them back to the drug makers, and everything else is what people of the compromise bill say. Now, people who want prescription only, a lot of law enforcement say, let's be done with it. Let's require prescription only, and then we don't have to worry about it.
This is State of the News on WFPL, and we're talking with Kenny Colston, the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. And we welcome your questions or comments, 502-814-TALK. That's 814-8255. You can reach us toll-free, 877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Well, Kenny, Governor Beshear in his inauguration said he was going to push for a constitutional amendment that would expand, or that would ask voters if they want expanded gaming in Kentucky. Where do we stand on that process at this point?
The governor said that he is still working on his bill. He was, I guess the way he described it was, is he was a little surprised at some of the help he's getting. I think specifically that's from a few Republicans in the state Senate, most importantly State Senator Damon Thayer of Georgetown. And I think that, you know, he was a little surprised at how many people are coming to support this initiative. I think he thought that he was going to have to use his 20-point victory in this election and kind of ram that constitutional amendment through. So he's trying to work out language. He's trying to find out what will pass both chambers and the General Assembly. But he did say we won't have to wait until February to see what that bill looks like. So that's kind of the deadline. If February 1st and we haven't seen the gambling bill yet, that's going to raise a lot of questions. But we should see it this week, upcoming week, next week, should be soon.
Do we know, has he specified whether he wants to allow casino gambling just at horse tracks, or would there be other facilities?
Well, Senator Thayer said that when he talked to the governor that the number 9 was mentioned. And obviously there, I believe, are 8 racetracks here in Kentucky that would get casinos, you know, your Turfway Parks, your Churchill Downs here in Louisville, and stuff like that. There's this, you know, 9th one out there that's kind of free floating. And a lot of people are, you know, kind of arguing over where that should be, whether 9 is, you know, too many. Will that draw out, you know, opposition? Because then that gives, you know, opponents to say, well, they could put a casino in your backyard. There's that one free floating one. So obviously that number will probably shrink a little bit. Thayer said he wasn't in favor of that. But you have to think that some casinos will have to be at racetracks. And it would be a surprise if Churchill Downs here in Louisville did not get one.
You also reported this week on a proposal that would allow for advertising on school buses.
Yes, this was a proposal that came up last session that made it out of the House but kind of just died quietly in the Senate. And what they want to do is be able to put advertising on school buses. But there are restrictions. No alcohol, no tobacco. There's an amendment that says you can't have anything that deals with sexual orientation on there.
Mm-hmm.
So lawmakers passed that out of committee once again this week. It is posted in the orders of the day for Monday for the full House. I expect it to pass the House. We'll have to see what happens in the Senate. But basically, it would not change the front of a school bus or the back of a school bus. You would have ads basically between the wheels on the side. And, you know, proponents of the legislation say it could raise up to $5,000 to $10,000 profit per bus. And I think they said in Jefferson County with 900 buses, that's $4.5 million. Obviously, with school funding looking to probably getting cut in this year's budget, anyway to gain revenue, obviously, is something that they want to look at, and we'll have to see where it goes.
Let's go to the phone. Suzanne is on the line. We were talking about the pseudoephedrine bill and the meth bill. Suzanne has a comment. Suzanne, welcome to State of the News.
Thank you.
What's on your
My
mind?
My comment or question is, I don't see the point in making pseudoephedrine by prescription only, thinking that that would solve the problem. Since hydrocodone, hydromorphone, oxycodone, all those are prescription only, and we have a huge problem with those.
Well, I guess pseudoephedrine could end up, on the black market.
Yeah, and that's a point that, you know, proponents of this compromise make. Don't make it a prescription. Kentucky's prescription problem is incredibly difficult already. That's why I think you'll see the pseudoephedrine issue wrapped into bills that tackle that, the pain clinics and the pain pill mills, and that go after doctors who prescribe that. I think in order to get the pseudoephedrine under control, you have to do both. And I think legislators really want to do both. They just haven't brought up the pain pill clinic right. bill yet, but they're going to. But that's a valid criticism of what some people say.
Suzanne, thanks for your call. Before we let you go, Kenny, there's been a lot of talk this week about the Agriculture Department. There's a new Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner who was the only Republican to win election to constitutional office in the most recent election, and he has called for an audit of the previous administration.
Yeah, things are not really looking well in the Agriculture Department. We knew that with outgoing Agriculture Commissioner Richie Farmer. New Commissioner James Comer has called for an audit. He's enlisted the help of a fellow Democrat, Adam Edelin, who's the new auditor, and they're going to be looking at everything in the office. It's kind of a chance for Comer to have a clean slate. We all know the news stories about Richie Farmer and the hiring scandals, what he paid for, what he didn't pay for. And Comer wants to do a clean slate. There's going to be a lot of distancing between Comer and Farmer and those administrations, even at the Republican Party level. And then today we find out that there's some $500,000 in missing equipment, computers, printers, trucks. So Comer's basically going to just air out all the dirty laundry. Let's get it out here. Let's move on.
Richie Farmer, also a Republican like Comer, so this has got to be politically uncomfortable, I would think.
Yeah, it's probably pretty uncomfortable, but you have to think, when you're that damaged as a political figure, your party has to separate from you a little bit, and Comer's just happened to do it a lot because there's a lot left over. So I'm sure it's not great for a Republican to basically air out this dirty laundry against another Republican, but if Comer has any hopes of being reelected or another higher office, he has to do it. He doesn't want to be dragged down by this.
All right. Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio, Frankfort Bureau Chief. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We move now from the Kentucky State Capitol to the Indiana State House, where the short 2012 session is now just over a week old, and there's been plenty of drama thus far as Republicans who control both houses and Governor Mitch Daniels are again pushing a right-to-work bill. Democrats have been trying to delay passage of the labor measure as long as possible. Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting has been covering the session, and before we talk to him, we want to hear a report he filed earlier this week for All Things Considered.
2012 isn't the first time Republicans have tried to pass right to work in Indiana. Last year, pushing the bill sent House Democrats fleeing to Illinois for 5 weeks, halting business in the legislature and forcing Republicans to take it off the table. This time around, Democrats have stayed in Indianapolis but off the House floor. They denied a quorum the first 3 days of session last week. Minority Leader Pat Bauer says the goal of his caucus is to buy more time for the public to study the bill.
This is such an important bill, such a controversial bill. The whole state ought to hear from it. We don't need to ram it through.
Republicans say they've done anything but. Over the summer, a legislative study committee took 20 hours of testimony on right to work, and a joint House and Senate committee spent more than 5 hours on the bill last week. Speaking at that committee meeting, Democratic Senator Jim Arnold all but conceded defeat.
I truly don't believe also that any minds or any votes are going to be changed by what was said here today.
The two sides seem entrenched. Right-to-work legislation would ban union contracts that require non-union employees pay fees for representation. Supporters say it will bring more jobs to Indiana. Opponents say it's nothing more than a union-busting bill that will create lower wages, health benefits, and worsen safety conditions. And with Democrats doing their best to stall it again, House Speaker Brian Bosma says this new session smacks of the movie Groundhog Day.
We will do our very best to encourage them to do what is right, which is to show up at work and do what they were elected to do. Even if you disagree with what you think the result might be, democracy is about participating, not going on strike.
But Republicans have some added leverage this time. An anti-bolting statute was passed last session, and daily $1,000 fines could be assessed on members absent 3 or more days straight without excuse. Bauer acknowledges the difficulty the threat of fines puts on his caucus.
And we know we can't stay out indefinitely, but we did need to slow the process down, which we've succeeded in doing.
Over the weekend, Democrats held public meetings around the state, and Monday, House Democrats returned to the floor, allowing the chamber to finally conduct business. But the legislative ceasefire didn't last long. Tuesday morning, Right to Work passed a House committee along party lines. The committee chairman didn't allow more public testimony or amendments to be heard, and House Democrats left the floor again. Whether they come in for session each day is in a constant state of flux. Brian Vargas teaches political science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He says the idea that Bauer keeps stressing is that more time will allow the public to be educated and make their voices heard. But he's not seeing any signs of that.
The hearings they had around the state did not generate that much coverage. And I don't know that they were attended by anybody but union members who were already involved.
Vargas says hoping public opinion will sway enough Republicans to defeat the measure is the equivalent of a Hail Mary pass. And even though Pat Bauer represents South Bend, home to the Fighting Irish, this legislative game appears to be in the final quarter. And it looks like there's little to stop Right to Work from becoming law in the coming weeks. For NPR News, I'm Brandon Smith from Indianapolis.
And joining us now on State of the News is Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I did a good job of kind of sorting out what was going on with the Right to Work there. So this piece aired on Wednesday. So have House Democrats come back to work since then?
They were there on Wednesday, yes. A deal was essentially struck. So far, as I mentioned in the piece, Democrats have been wanting to delay this process as long as possible, giving them time to have these public hearings around the state to get the word out about what right to work really means, at least according to Democrats. And so the Speaker of the House and the House Minority Leader got together and struck a bargain and said, we will hold off, the Speaker said, we will hold off the next step in the legislative process, which is the amendment process on the floor of the House. We will hold that off until next Tuesday. So that gives Democrats another weekend to hold those public meetings. And so Democrats have been in the chamber ever since.
And it looks like Pat Bauer, the Democratic leader, is now floating the idea of a referendum.
He is now floating the idea of a referendum. It's something the Democrats have talked about for a while anyway, that they would like this to be put to the public. Pat's wanted several things. He said, let's push this issue until the next legislative session so it can be a campaign issue in the November elections. But certainly Republicans weren't going to agree to that because they feel this is an issue that needs to be addressed right away. So now Democrats will, on Tuesday, in that amendment process, offer an amendment that would put it to a referendum. And there is at least some Republican support for that, though whether there's enough remains to be seen.
Now, this session, correct me if I'm wrong, this session is going to overlap with the Super Bowl that's coming to Indianapolis, right?
It absolutely will, yeah.
So there appears to be, and no one has really come out and said it, I don't think, but there appears to be sort of a rush to get this thing passed before the Super Bowl in order to avoid any negative publicity.
Well, nobody's come out and said that. In fact, when asked that specific question, the Speaker has always been very quick to say, that's not what we're trying to do here. If it passes before or after the Super Bowl, doesn't matter to us. We just want it passed, period. Though they have certainly pushed it ahead, at least initially, as quickly as they could, though now they've delayed it a little bit more. But you're working in a shorter session anyway. This is a non-budget year, so we're only going to go to about the middle of March, which is a month and a half less than a budget session does. And so you're working with a constrained time schedule anyway, and the Super Bowl is going to shorten that even a little bit more because they aren't going to be working that entire week anyway.
Now, there is sort of a rush to get a smoking ban, a statewide smoking ban passed by its supporters before the Super Bowl, correct?
Well, honestly, again, that's another one that supporters of the smoking ban say it would be nice if we could get it before the Super Bowl, but we just want to get it passed. This has been a fight for supporters of the smoking ban that's been going on for 6 years. This is the sixth straight year that a smoking ban has gone before the General Assembly. It's gotten out of the House the last five. It only got a committee hearing in the Senate last year. That was the first time it had even gotten that far in the Senate. So they're hoping they found the sweet spot this time around. But that's another one that they're cautious to say, we're not trying to push this before the Super Bowl. One bill that they are pushing before the Super Bowl is a bill that will close gaps in Indiana's human trafficking laws, because that's been, in the past two Super Bowls in Dallas and Miami, that's been a huge problem in those areas that cropped up around the Super Bowl. You have just a huge influx of people into the city for the event, and you also have a huge influx, therefore, of human trafficking going on and sex trafficking going on. So the Attorney General, the governor, and state legislators have put together a bill that they're trying to get through as quickly as possible so that it will be in place so they can crack down on this issue before the Super Bowl.
And got about a minute or so left. I don't know how much you've covered this, but there's been a lot of publicity about schools having the option now of not teaching cursive writing, and there's been a bill filed in response to that that would require them to teach cursive writing.
Yeah, that created quite a hubbub when the Department of Education came out last year and said that they're no longer going to have to do that. And the cursive writing portion of that bill has been lumped in with a number of other things, including like class basketball and some other things. So it'll be interesting to see how that moves forward. That took its first step in a committee earlier this week, but it's got a long way to go still.
Brandon Smith covers the Indiana State House for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take another break. Ann Marshall of LEO Weekly joins us to talk about a space simulation program at a local school. It's coming up next. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Louisville's Academy at Shawnee is one of 48 sites of a Challenger Learning Center. It's a program that allows children, among other things, to go on a simulated space mission. Ann Marshall has been writing about it, writes about the program in this week's LEO Weekly, and is here to talk about it. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you.
Pardon me while I clear my throat. So, first of all, what exactly is a Challenger Learning Center? What happens there?
Well, a group of kids come in, and there's two separate rooms, and there's a mission control room and an actual room that is supposed to replicate a shuttle. And so students will come, and there's a couple different missions they can do, one being a moon mission, going to the moon, another being Mars, and then there's a rendezvous with a comet, I believe. And the purpose of it is to integrate lessons that these children are learning on space science into this sort of fun simulation of going into space. And so the kids get separated into two separate rooms, and they go on a simulated mission, and they get to wear the little NASA vests and have a rendezvous in space.
Is this geared to a particular age group?
Yes, it's middle school primarily. I think, you know, anyone who wants to attend can. They certainly want many field trips there. But it's geared towards middle school, since at JCPS, that is when space science is introduced. So, yeah.
And you say there are 48 of these around
mm-hmm.
the world.
Mm-hmm.
So how did one end up here in Louisville?
Well, this one was actually originally in Radcliffe. And a couple years ago, the city of Radcliffe could no longer afford to have it. And I've been told that it was sort of a choice between keeping the police force staffed or keeping this open.
Wow.
So they basically put it up for sale. And it was the Academy at Shawnee's magnet coordinator who heard about this and decided that they wanted to bring it to Academy at Shawnee, which is an aerospace magnet. You can get your pilot's license there in high school. And so, which is different than space, but so they want you to, you know, to bring things that are in line with what they're trying to teach and what they're trying to draw kids in there for. So The school board agreed to pay a little under $300,000 to bring it to Academy at Shawnee, and it opened last January.
Now, is there any other cost associated with it? Is there a cost to come and be a part of it?
Well, the school district has about a $250,000 budget for the Challenger Learning Center, and the idea is that enough field trips will come that fund will be reimbursed and it will sustain itself. And that is why they really are trying to recruit, you know, whoever wants to come. They even have corporate missions, so to speak. And there are two teachers on staff there as well as an administrative person. So that's the costs that they have associated with it right now. Yeah.
Now, the shuttle program, of course, is coming to an end. Is this going to have any bearing on these centers?
You know, I was curious about that, and I'm not sure yet. I think that they are trying to keep that era alive. I mean, NASA has said that human space flight isn't over yet. It just seems that it's not quite clear where it's headed. They definitely want to keep this era alive, and it's a tribute to the Challenger shuttle, that tragedy in 1986. So.
And I understand some experiments are being conducted. Correct me if I'm wrong. Being conducted at the Academy are part of the bigger program, space program.
Right, right. The principal of Academy at Shawnee, one thing that he was saying is that the Challenger Learning Center may be a sort of ancillary to what they do at the Academy at Shawnee. It's something for middle school, but it's creating a place where they are now the space sort of related high school, and since the Challenger Learning Center has been there, they were one of 16 teams across the U.S. to put an experiment on the Shuttle Endeavor, which was the last shuttle to run. So,
all right. You can read about the Challenger Learning Center at the Academy at Shawnee in Leo Weekly, an article written by Ann Marshall. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information on topics discussed on today's show, visit our website, WFPL.org. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News team. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Haldick. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.